This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
I wanted to start maybe a series of teachings tonight by speaking about the Buddha and his life and his quest for liberation. His experience of liberation, and then over the next several months, probably the rest of the year, speaking about the core teachings of the Buddha, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path. I've been doing this, those of you who come to the West Side, I started with the Buddha's life in January, and we're still on the Eightfold Path. We're still in the middle of the core teachings halfway through the year. Actually, if I take my time, I could spend a whole year just talking about the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, which is really all the Buddha taught. It's really the core teachings of the Buddha. And it's all you need to know in order to end your suffering and to start your life. Of course, just knowing it's not enough. You actually have to apply it. You actually have to practice it. You actually have to live it. But knowing it's a start, anyways, it's a place to begin. The Buddha is a person. He's not a totally mythical character. He existed historically, verified as a person who lived about 2,550 or so years ago, born in northern India at the time, what was northern India, now is with the current border, southern Nepal. And it's interesting to talk about the person and the quest and the search for enlightenment, not so much as just a kind of way to talk about this historical person who became enlightened, but that really the story is an archetypal story about transformation. And so as we're speaking about it, I ask you to also reflect on how it relates to you, not just as an interesting story, but this story of transformation and this quest for happiness, and how it relates to your quest for happiness, how it relates to your experience of life, the difficulties of life, and finding some solutions for this difficult life that we're all having. There's a lot of myth, you know, the thing about religions and these kind of Jesus and Buddha and Muhammad is that it just, you know, these guys were real dudes, but their life just gets so exaggerated over the centuries. And people just love to make them magic, and it feels to me like when you read the core teachings of the Buddha, like he's really clearly interested in a like scientific, psychological, kind of grounded reality approach, but that people over the years have assigned all of these sort of like mystical, magical miracles to the Buddha. That human beings aren't satisfied with just he was a righteous person who was happy and found a way to deal with life in a practical way. They have to make it fantastic. Even the story of the Buddha's birth, rather than it seems historically accurate that actually his mother died in childbirth, or right around his birth, his mother died. He was actually ended up being raised by his aunt and his father. But rather than just, it was this sort of awful, traumatic experience of birth, the myth of the Buddha's birth is that he stepped out of his mother's rib cage. No wonder she died. And immediately took 8 steps, and in his footsteps, lotuses blossomed. You know, this kind of newborn, walking, talking, fully, kind of... Okay. So rather than, the kind of story becomes mythologized into this fantastic experience of... And rather than having overprotective parents, the way that the story goes is that there was a prophecy that this baby would either be a great spiritual leader or a great warrior king. And his father was a warrior king. And so his father wanted to make sure that he didn't become a spiritual teacher and that he went into the family business of, taxing and warring and running shit. Technical term of government. It's said that he was born into a family of wealth and power, and that often it's said that he's a prince, Prince Siddhartha Gautama, that his father was a king of a small kingdom, not like of all of India, but that at this time India is sort of small nation states and warring factions and just a lot of kind of, my neighborhood against your neighborhood, sort of like LA still is. Although now people have become so interested in the myth of this sort of prince and father's a king has just been accepted for centuries, and nobody really ever, that's just the story. He was a prince, his dad was the king, they were wealthy, they had all of these castles, and the stories, it says he never spent a whole season in the same castle. He had the spring and the fall and the summer castle, he had his place in Bel Air and then a place out of Malibu, and always spent the winters in the desert. One of the teachers that I like, Stephen Batchelor, who's a bit of a skeptic, self-proclaimed Buddhist atheist, he got very interested in, how much of this is accurate. So he actually went with architects and, archaeologists. to see, is there any proof, historical proof of these castles that he's said to have grown up in Lumbini, in the place where he was born. And so I guess that if you dig down, I think that they said 15 feet, you can get to 2,500 years ago. Something like that. If you go down about 15 feet into the earth, you'll find the kind of ruins of about 2,500 years ago. And so they've done it. They've excavated all over Lumbini, the place of the Buddha's birth, to find the castles that he grew up in. And as it turns out, that actually in that time, there weren't even bricks being made. So they can't. The only foundations that they find are sort of like dirt foundations. Not, you think of a castle, at least has to be made out of bricks or stones or something substantial. But as it turns out, that 2,500 years ago in that part of northern India, all of the structures were like mud huts. Maybe you could actually have a 2-story mud hut. I don't know. Maybe you could have a mud castle, but it's like adobe. It's like mud and straw and clay kind of put together. It's not stone buildings. It's not brick buildings. And so it just kind of points to how mythologized the story gets. and how humans just have this devotional tendency to say, like, my teacher is the best. The Buddha was so fucking rich. You can't believe it. He had the biggest mud hut in town. It was like a palace, that mud hut. But the way that the story goes is that this guy, Siddhartha, had everything. Everything that he wanted, he got. You know, he was spoiled, wealthy, educated. Got everything that he wanted. But that at his core, he realized that getting everything that he wanted, having all of the material, all of the attention, that there was still something missing. That he was not satisfied. And I think this is really where the story begins and the quest for enlightenment, and where we can look at our own lives, because I think that this is really where transformation begins, with dissatisfaction. Seeking freedom, seeking liberation, awakening, health, healing, whatever, always is on the foundation of being unsatisfied with what you're experiencing in your life. If you're satisfied, you're not going to start meditating. You start meditating, you start seeking spiritual teachings, and because of dissatisfaction. And so this was the case for the Buddha. And the way that the story goes is that he was dissatisfied with getting everything he wanted and it not working. Maybe there's some people in the room who have that kind of experience, where you're coming to meditation because you got everything you wanted. You got the career. You got the relationship. You got maybe the money, the success. Maybe, or at least on some level or another. And you thought, oh, I'll be happy when I have this level of success. Or I'll be happy when I have this marriage or these children, or I'll be happy. And then you get it and you say, oh, it didn't work. I'm not as satisfied as I thought I would be getting here. Many of us, actually, the dissatisfaction isn't from getting what I wanted, what we wanted, but it's the suffering of not getting what we wanted or what we needed, actually. Not being safe, not being healthy, the suffering of addiction, the dissatisfaction of repetitive dysfunctional behaviors that just led to suffering and more suffering, the dissatisfaction of a life of pain and lack and neglect and trauma, not the dissatisfaction of a life of abundance and ease. But it doesn't actually matter what you're dissatisfied with. This is hard to understand for some of us. That whether it's Siddhartha having everything, everything doesn't satisfy. Or it's the rest of us having not everything and feeling, I don't know, maybe it's actually better. Maybe it's actually easier when you've had everything to know that doesn't work. Because that pervasive delusion, that pervasive human delusion that says, I'll be happy when I get everything. If I had enough money, if I had enough attention, if I was having the right kind of sex, then I'd be happy. If I had the right kind of attention, the right kind of... then I'd be happy. But the story is, Siddhartha had it all. The right kind of sex, the right kind of attention, the right kind of everything. But there was something in his core that knew there had to be something more than sense pleasures and material goods. That sense pleasures and material goods did not create happiness. This became more and more clear as the story, as the myth goes, as he encountered what are called the heavenly messengers. And that is the fact that no matter how much youth and money and sickness is inevitable. And maybe you can reflect on your relationship to sickness. And that sickness was a real wake-up call for him. He's like, really? Like, this body can just get sick? I can't control this body? Subject to diseases and illnesses? I can't sustain pleasure. I have to deal with pain and sickness. And then that was a real wake-up call. And old age, aging, the fact that this body continues to age, we get so identified with this body, but gravity always wins. That the process of aging beyond our control, and the fact of death, the messenger of impermanence, that youth fades, illness is a given, disease, and death inevitable. And of course, this is also in the Indian view of reincarnation. So it's not only sickness, old age, death, it's sickness, old age, death, over and over and over and over. And that sort of wake-up call, like, not only am I, this lifetime is difficult, but I got to do it again and again and again and again. And so part of Sid's quest was, is it possible to end this cycle of suffering, the cycle of sickness, old age, death? Can I awaken? Is there a possibility of coming to a place of deathlessness? The end of this cycle of rebirth over and over? Now, some of us, some Buddhists, and depending on my mood, I can take different views. Like to look at the teaching of reincarnation literally as actually lifetime to lifetime, and that there's a birth and sometimes it's looked at as just moment to moment, that this is psychological analogy for loss, for death, of a moment, of a phase of life. That the deathless that the Buddha is awakening to isn't even about reincarnation. It's about the present moment. Can I come to a way to live moment to moment that is free from suffering? Free from the suffering of identification with this body as the source of my happiness or my mind or my emotions, to something that is liberated from this transient, temporary, unfolding process of being. The fourth sickness, old age, death, wake-up call, I'm going to die, what's this life about? I'm going to get old. What's this life about? Or I'm already old. What's this life about? The fourth messenger, wake-up call for the Buddha, pre-Buddha, Siddhartha, was that he met a meditator, somebody who had dedicated their life to spiritual practice, and he got inspired. He had a knowing, an internal dissatisfaction, an internal kind of spontaneous craving, kind of healthy quest. He knew he was seeking something more than sense pleasures and material goods. And he met somebody who said, I had dedicated my life to a spiritual process, to an internal process, to not seeking my happiness through sense pleasures and accumulation, but through renunciation and discipline and meditation. And it really spoke to him. There was something inside of Sid that said, I want to do that. I can do that. I'm going to dedicate my life to doing that. Later, when he becomes the Buddha and he looks back on what led to his liberation, he said, the first thing that led to my liberation was that I had faith. And so this is interesting for us to reflect on. I would say, actually, the first thing is you had enough dissatisfaction. The second thing is, because you can have dissatisfaction and just hopelessness, which is how most of us have lived most of our lives. I'm totally dissatisfied and I'm just fucked. I'm just hopeless. But it's dissatisfaction and hope. And more than hope, like faith and confidence. When the Buddha met that meditator, it inspired in him the confidence to practice, to find out for himself the end of suffering, to find for himself the solution. We all have our own stories of what has been so difficult and unsatisfactory in our lives. What is it that has brought us to such desperation as we're willing to meditate? It's become that bad. I'll even meditate. I don't know. I guess maybe it's not like that for everybody. Like for me, meditation was like the last stop. It wasn't cool. It wasn't acceptable by my peer group. And for me, as a young punk rocker, it was like joining the enemy. It was like selling out to, and I wasn't sure what was worse, like becoming religious or becoming a hippie. Or like a religious hippie. A deep, deep hopelessness to be willing to say, I'll even try meditating. But there was some confidence, there was some faith, there was some hope that said, maybe this will work. Nothing else has worked. Maybe this will work. So looking for ourselves, what was the dissatisfaction in your life? And then also, what was it that gave you, in your quest for awakening, what is it that has given you some confidence? What inspires you? And it's important, actually, to name it and to sometimes come back to it. Because at times on our path, we'll forget completely. We'll get into doubt. We'll get into disenchantment, disillusionment. And it's important to remember, I used to have some confidence. I used to have some faith. What was that? And to be able to bring that up, to remind ourselves. of what used to inspire us, even if currently it's not. The heavenly messenger of the practitioner. There's a tricky part in the story here where Siddhartha had been in a marriage and had, just before this change in his attitude and outlook and desire for liberation, he had had a child. He had a newborn son. This is a tricky part in the story because he leaves his wife and child to go find liberation. He doesn't feel like he can find it at home, in his householder, father, husband role. And he leaves. And he goes away for 7 years, studying with different teachers and practicing on his own. And this is, it can be a little bit confusing of like, wait a minute. This guy abandoned his family? We're listening to him? I like on some level, I like the how human it is, actually. How it makes him accessible, imperfect. Rather than he's this sort of perfect guy that just becomes more and more perfect. It's a place where the sort of they break out of the myth and they're like, actually, he was kind of a deadbeat before he got enlightened. He just ditched his family. He made his meditation practice more important than his children. Not a very enlightened activity, actually, to do that. But he was an unenlightened, confused. He even refers to himself. He says, back when I was a poor, unenlightened bodhisattva, when I was just seeking liberation, but I was still in ignorance and delusion. I would hope that actually if the Buddha had already been enlightened, he would have not left his child for 7 years. But as an unenlightened person on a spiritual quest, that's exactly what he did. He took off. Now there's another way to look at it, that he, sometimes we can look at it and say, he felt that he didn't have anything to leave his son. And that actually, sometimes it's said that in leaving, he said, I'm going forth to find some inheritance. I have nothing to give you. I have no wisdom to impart to you. I don't know how to end suffering. Your inheritance is going to be sickness, old age, and death. That's all this life really has to offer. He said, I'm going forth to find the deathless, to find liberation, and I will return to my family, to my son, when I have found the solution, the end of suffering. And as the story goes, that's exactly what he does. He goes off for several years, 7 years or so. And as soon as he gets enlightened, within the first year or so, he comes back. And his 7-year-old son joins the monastic order. His son's name is Rahula, and his joins the monastic order and lives with the Buddha, I guess, for the rest of his life. He's in the suttas, in the historical teachings, several times where the Buddha's teaching him and parenting him in the way that a Buddha does. When Siddhartha leaves home and goes out to seek guidance, to find a meditative path. He comes into contact with the most reputable teachers of his time in his area around northern India. He travels and he looks for teachings. And I actually think that this is quite a useful part of the story and probably something that you can relate to. Maybe you've been seeking and listening to a lot of different perspectives, and he does that, and he goes and listens to the different gurus and, you know, yoga teachers and meditation teachers, and for himself, checks it out. And it said that he finds this reportedly enlightened teacher, and he studies with him for quite a while and learns the meditation practice. But he trusts himself. He takes this meditation practice, which sounds like some kind of concentration, like maybe a mantra type of practice, and he takes it to the highest level that is possible with it. And the teacher says, "You got it. You're enlightened." And Siddhartha says, "Something very cool happened while I was meditating, but if this is enlightenment, that's not what I'm looking for, because all this does is give me a meditative escape. While I'm concentrated, while I'm meditating in this way, I get really high. I get really free. But when I'm not concentrated in that way, my mind still attacks me. I'm still suffering. I'm still identified with this body and subject to sickness, old age, and death. I'm not looking for a temporary fix. I'm looking for real freedom. You want to teach me how to relax? I didn't come here to learn how to relax. I want to get free." And he rejects the teachings that he comes into contact with. And I think that this is a really important part of the archetype of self-reliance, of not saying like, "Oh, well, my teacher said," not looking or trusting the tradition, where he says, "Yes, this is your perspective of enlightenment. My direct experience does not fit with what you're saying is liberation. I'm not satisfied. I'm not accepting this. I'm going to keep going. I'm going to keep my quest going." Finds another teacher, has a similar experience. It sounds like he's meditating. He says, "I get to the place of no perception, where the body dissolves. There's no these kind of experiences of emptiness, these meditative phenomena. But then when I'm not meditating, the mind comes back, the body comes back. Greed, hatred, and delusion, attachment, aversion, the real causes of suffering, continue when I'm not meditating." And he continues, he says, "I want to find a way to end greed, hatred, and delusion, the causes of suffering, the causes of rebirth." So he continues, and he continues. There's a long period in his life where he practices asceticism, where he studied with the yoga teachers, he studied with the, you know, learned the mantras, he studied the kind of Hindu, Indian wisdom of that's available to him. And one of the popular practices at that time and to this day in India is the practice of asceticism, where it's this idea that maybe your identification with the body is really the problem. So if you can do an extreme denial of the body's wants and desires, that will lead you to liberation. If you kind of torture your body and deny your body in this really hardcore renunciation, beyond celibacy to like, sometimes, because Buddhism, after the Buddha's enlightenment, the Buddhism is called the middle path. And the middle path for the monastics is celibate. No sex. And people say, "That doesn't seem balanced. That seems a little extreme." But the ascetics take it not just to celibacy, but to like genital torture. Not don't use your genitals, but like you should cut them off maybe, or sew them up, or encase them in, like the sadhus have this practice, the males of like putting their balls and penis in clay so that you can't get an erection no matter what. I don't know how many of you have been to India, but it's sort of fun to check out the sadhus. And a lot of the sadhus will like do tricks, like they'll be like, I'll lift this 50-pound boulder with my penis for 3 rupees. And they're like, you know, just torturing their genitals. So that's considered an extreme. Celibacy is considered balance. You don't have to torture your genitals. You don't have to use them, but you don't have to torture them. So the Buddha goes and tortures his genitals for like 6 years. Pre-enlightenment, this extreme asceticism. He fasts, he doesn't eat, he says he stands for weeks, his body becomes skeletal. He says by the end of his asceticism practice, he can reach into his abdomen and grab his own spine, where his body is just dying. Skin, he said, my hair is falling off, my skin is sagging. He's hardcore. He goes to the full extreme. The long earlobes on Buddha statues are because of stretching the earlobes with stones and sticks, and some people will say, oh no, that's the sort of sign of wisdom, or no, that's what happens when you stretch your earlobes with shoving rocks into your piercings. It's not like nice, you know, zero gauge what the kids do these days. Towards the end of that, the Buddha reflects on the extremes of his life. He said, I had everything, all the pleasure, all of the stuff, all of the attention. I inherited the kingdom. I was going to be the king. I was going to have the biggest mud hut in the village. And I wasn't happy. I renounced everything. I gave it all up. I lived naked in the forest, torturing myself. I denied this body. I had no sense pleasures. I practically killed myself. I still wasn't happy. Indulgence did not lead to well-being in my life. Extreme renunciation did not lead to well-being in my life, to internal ease. He rejected the ascetic practice, the self-denial and torture. He said, I've got to find some balance here. Maybe there's something in between indulgence and extreme renunciation. And it's at that point when he actually discovers, and by most accounts, it's the Siddhartha, the Buddha, who discovers mindfulness. He says that concentration, where I ignore everything else, didn't work. This extreme renunciation didn't work. But if I just bring an open awareness, a present time awareness, to not only what's happening, but how it feels. Is it pleasant? Is it unpleasant? And this sort of scientific experiment begins to happen. And he starts to realize that the real solution isn't avoiding pleasure, but it's meeting pleasure with non-attachment. Seeing that pleasure and pain are impermanent, that it's not about seeking pain or avoiding pain, but it's accepting that unpleasantness and pain is going to be part of life, and meeting pain with compassion rather than indulging in it or hating it. And this becomes a real turning point in the quest, in the transformation. Not about avoidance or indulgence, but about how we relate to what's happening. About how he begins to relate to the pleasures and the pains of existence. And he begins to practice mindfulness. rejects the ascetic path, and some young woman sees that he's starving to death. And I think she's like a cow herder, and she has milk and yogurt, curd, stuff like that, and starts to offer him food. And he's been practicing with some other ascetics. And they feel like he has completely, as soon as he starts accepting food, they're like, oh, you sold out. You completely, you're not spiritual. You're going to eat food, really? You fucking lost it. And, you know, feel critical and judgmental, and he feels, you know, he's ostracized by his peers because they are seeing him as indulgent. You're eating yogurt, you're letting that woman feed you yogurt, not torturing your genitals. Lost it. For days he regains his health, and this is brings us to the place in the story where he finally he feels like he's doing meditation, sitting meditation, walking meditation. He's reflecting. He's trying. He feels like, I'm close. I'm getting close. And he finally gets this resolve. He says, I'm just going to sit here under this tree, the Bodhi tree, the tree of enlightenment, and I'm just going to take this seat until I see through, until I have insight into what causes suffering and what will end suffering, until I gain liberation, until I awaken to the deathless. And I'll go into in detail his experience under the Bodhi tree in the next lecture in a couple weeks when I'm back.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.